Caroline?
Thank you very much, Madam Deputy Speaker, and I beg to move the bill be now read a second time. It is an honour to have brought this bill to Parliament today. It is the result of widespread consultation, and it has extensive backing from a raft of doctors and nurses delivering frontline care, as well as from local NHS campaign groups. Its backers include the BMA Council, the President of the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health, as well as many, many local NHS staff and campaigners. And I want to pay tribute to them for all of their amazing work, and pay tribute too to Alison Pollock, the Professor of Public Health Research and Policy at Queen Mary University of London, and Peter Roderick, who is a barrister and senior research fellow, for all of their expertise and help as well. Now, Madam Deputy Speaker, this incredibly positive and wide range of popular support for the bill reflects a strong belief in a publicly provided NHS. People are rightly worried because the NHS, consistently ranked one of the best in the world, is under threat as never before. Under threat from underfunding dressed up as efficiency savings, under threat from cuts, under threat from the wasteful bidding of the internal market, under threat from the creeping commercialisation and steep increase in corporate sector contracts since the 2012 Health and Social Care Act. I give way.
Is it not the case that the Health Select Committee report in 2010 showed that the running costs of the NHS had more than doubled from 6% to 14% based on the purchaser-provider split? And that's even before the outsourcing and tendering process of the Health and Social Care Act.
Yeah.
Very grateful to the Honourable Member for her intervention, and also, of course, she speaks with great expertise in this area, and she is absolutely right that the creeping privatisation, marketisation is incredibly inefficient, apart from all of the other problems that it is causing. I will.
I'm very grateful to the Honourable Lady give way, and I'm sure everyone in the House sympathises with the lack of time she's got for moving her second reading. Would she agree with me that the NHS is also direly threatened by the imposition of the brutal pay restraint policies which do such damage to recruitment and retention, especially in places like Oxford?
Yeah.
I'm very grateful to his intervention. Absolutely agree with him that it is no wonder that we can't recruit more nurses and doctors when they are treated so badly by this government, when they are not appreciated for the expertise that they bring.
The Honourable Lady give way on that point.
Thank
the Honourable Lady for giving way. To my Honourable friend's point a little point stage further. The government exalts the virtues of the people that work in the National Health Service, yet they've offered them a paltry 1%. Don't you think they could do better than that?
Grateful to him, and yes, I was exactly about to come on to that. I think that 1% is frankly insulting, and it's not surprising that there is so much concern within the NHS amongst their staff, because it's not only the finance, it's the way in which they're being treated generally. In fact, time and again we have a health minister who is constantly undermining their professionalism, and I think that that is helping to push our NHS into crisis. Now, to see off the many threats that our NHS faces, this bill is guided by the principles of the National Health Service Act 1946. The bill reinstates the Secretary of State's duty to provide services throughout England. It is time, once and for all, to put an end to the purchaser-provider split. In 2 seconds, I will. This split is the harmful cornerstone of the commercialisation of our health service. It is the open door that lets the health corporations in to pick off the most profitable NHS contracts. I give way.
Lady for giving way, and congratulate her on bringing forward this bill, which of course relates to attempting to prevent the dismantling of the NHS in England and Wales. But does the Honourable Lady appreciate that the dismantling of the NHS in England and Wales is a threat to the NHS in Scotland, because our funding is linked to English public expenditure through the Barnett formula? And will she recognise that SNP MPs are here in number today at the request of their constituents?
And I'm grateful for her intervention, because she is absolutely right. I must say I'm very grateful to my SNP colleagues for being here today and for being so patient as we wait to get to this point. And of course, they are absolutely related. What happens with the NHS in England does have those consequences for the NHS in Scotland, absolutely linked, and that's why I'm so grateful that she and her colleagues are here today. Now, the split has allowed NHS privatisation in England to increase dramatically since the Health and Social Care Act. I will not give way, if he doesn't mind, simply because I want to make a bit more progress, and there are many people on this side who have waited a very long time to get into this debate. This split has allowed NHS privatisation in England to increase dramatically since the Health and Social Care Act was passed 4 years ago. The most recent official figures show that in 2013-14, the NHS paid £6.6 billion to private healthcare firms, and that figure is increasing. Some people suggest as far as £10 billion. I will.
Member for giving way. Bristol Clinical Commissioning Group, which issues contracts for local NHS service, is in the process of striking out rules that prevent tax avoiding private companies from securing NHS contracts for fear of litigation. Does the Honourable Lady share my worry that the only health concern for some of these private contractors is ensuring that they have healthy profits?
Yeah.
She makes her point very strongly and compellingly, and I do absolutely agree with her.
Will the Honourable Member give way?
I will.
Can I thank the Honourable Member for giving way? And there are, just remind you that there are Labour members here as well. But as a member of the Health Select Committee between 2010 and 2015, this bill is vitally important. Does she agree with me that it's necessary to overturn the reorganisation that took place that nobody wanted but cost £3 billion?
I'm grateful to her for her intervention, and I do pay tribute to the Labour colleagues who are here, unfortunately not enough to be able to make sure that we could have had a closure vote earlier, for which I am sorry. But she's absolutely right to tackle head-on the issue of reorganisation, because of course some will argue that the NHS cannot face yet more reorganisation. And while on one level I agree that in some senses that is another big thing that we can't necessarily face, in 2 seconds I shall, I simply want to say that the alternative of carrying on down the route that we are going right now is absolutely impossible. And the way in which this bill is framed is precisely to make sure that the reform is taken over time, that is allowed organically, and frankly, I just simply don't think we can do without it, but I will give way.
I thank the Honourable Lady for giving way. I would just point out that the NHS is actually being reorganised on a daily, weekly and monthly basis. Every time a service is outsourced, it is completely reorganised by being taken over, people's contracts changed and the services shape changed. I would like to point out that in Scotland we reversed the purchaser-provider split back in 2004, and it actually was relatively painless. It is simply a decision to not outsource further and to gradually move back to geographical health planning instead of this fragmentation of CCGs at a time when we need integration.
I think that intervention was incredibly helpful because it does show what is possible. The fact that it has been done in Scotland without major problems demonstrates that if the political will is there, changes can be made. I give one.
I'm grateful for the Honourable Member giving way. The urgency of this bill is very notable because the reality is, in my constituency of York, a hospital closed in 5 days because of competition, because of the fragmentation in service. And therefore, isn't it essential we do everything we can to bring a collaborative, planned service together now?
I'm grateful for her intervention, and she must have very good eyesight, because I was about to come on to exactly that point, that we need a planned service, not one based on competition all the time. And for those who say that the private sector is only a small part of our NHS, I would make 3 important points. First, that the private sector causes enormous harm by cherry-picking profitable services. Second, that there has been an undeniable escalation of private sector involvement since the Health and Social Care Act 2012, and the direction of travel is very plain. And third, that material harm is being caused by this purchaser-provider split, which puts, as the Honourable Lady said, competition above cooperation, and sees NHS bodies literally bidding against each other, and I simply cannot see in whose interest that is. No, I'm sorry, I won't, because he's had plenty of time, about 2 hours already this morning, to speak. I will say a little bit more about each of these points. On cherry-picking, Madam Deputy Speaker, on the issue of cherry-picking, the inescapable truth is that the private sector is camping out on the lawn of the NHS. It is using all the corporate machinery available to it to pick off the low-hanging fruit, the non-urgent, easy and profitable services. The 2012 Act handed the private sector unprecedented access to NHS markets. Invited in to browse, predictably, they have seized the simple, profitable work, sending complications back to the NHS to mop up any mistakes or unforeseen outcomes.
I thank the Honourable Lady for giving way. I have asked on several occasions in this chamber about the contribution of the Health and Social Care Act to the current financial state that the NHS in England is in. And we constantly hear that it's all just due to agency nurses. And yet, when we look at the 5 years before the change, the NHS managed somehow to balance its books and went to a debt of £100 million, £800 million, and now we're looking at £2.5 billion. And that is because we are not actually looking after everyone, we're giving them the cheap people and the NHS ends up with the expensive people.
Here. Well, I thank her. It's a very well put point and put very well indeed. Yes, I will give one.
I thank the Honourable Lady for finally being able to bring this debate to the House. Does she agree with me that the real issue with privatisation of the health service is that the money that they make goes into the pockets of the shareholders and not back into patient care?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it is just criminal, frankly, that the money that the NHS so desperately needs in order to be able to provide that frontline care is actually going to line the pockets of private shareholders, private companies. No, I will not. For a gentleman who has spent about 2 hours boring on this morning, I will not give way. Now, the private sector is profiting from NHS training. It is depriving the NHS of income. It is removing valuable day-to-day training experience. Take the example of the surgeon who no longer gets to practice on schedules elective work, who as a result then has to refer an emergency shoulder injury to a specialist unit when it could have been dealt with at a lower level, but they had just lost the experience and lost the practice. With pleasure.
Thank you, Madam Deputy Speaker. I'm grateful to Honourable Lady for giving way, and I congratulate her on bringing this bill forward. In communities like mine in Whitehaven, Milham, Keswick, Maryport, Workington and elsewhere, we're really feeling the effect of the government policy right now, and it's hollowing out the NHS. There's no two ways about that. Where in this bill, because this bill does require a lot of work, and I wouldn't favour another reorganisation, where in this bill would there be provision made for the NHS to recognise explicitly the difficulties and the differences in providing health care in rural, isolated, peripheral areas, which is fundamentally different to how it should be provided in more urban areas?
Thank him for his intervention, and I think that's something that will be explored in committee. I cannot point him right now to the relevant clause, but I think it's a very serious point. But I would say that we will have a better chance to be able to have that kind of managed and planned NHS where you can make sure that the services in rural areas are appropriate and those in urban areas are appropriate if you have a guiding mind back in charge of the NHS, and that is exactly what was broken when that provider purchaser split was made. So I think it's a good point, and it's one I would love to see debated further in committee. Now, when it comes to the overall direction of travel and the duty to provide, I think it's quite shocking that private hospital share of NHS-funded patients grew rapidly between 2006 and 2011. By 2010-11, private companies performed 17% of hip replacements, 17% of hernia repairs, and handled 8% of patients. First attendances in relation to orthopaedics or trauma, such as broken limbs, also increased. Yet it is the NHS that invests in the training, it is the NHS that picks up the pieces when things go wrong in the private sector, and it is the NHS that so often innovates. So following the Coalition's Health and Social Care Act of 2012, the NHS Support Federation has been charting the impact of government policy on the use of outside providers to deliver and plan NHS care. Their report out last month charts the continuing steep escalation of creeping private sector involvement in our NHS. The research shows that over 400 NHS clinical contracts worth £16 billion have been awarded through the market since April 2013. Over this time, the private sector has won nearly £5.5 billion. So let me give a few examples of the kind of corporate takeover that we're talking about. In September 2015, Capita, despite its chequered record in the provision of public services, took control of a contract worth £1 billion to be the provider of primary care services in England. In October 2015, Virgin Care won a five-year, £64 million contract to provide community child health services in Wiltshire from Wiltshire CCG, Wiltshire Council and the NHS England. As of April 2016, services including children's specialist community nursing, health visiting and speech and language therapy will all transfer to Virgin Care. And in my own constituency, the private company Optum, part of the giant American corporation United Health, last year won a £1.5 million contract from Brighton & Hove CCG for referral management services. Now, this kind of outsourcing goes on despite a trail of failed, terminated and collapsed contracts, like the £235 million contract for provision of musculoskeletal services in West Sussex that was awarded but never begun once it was determined just how much damage the contract would do to other NHS services in the region. Then there was the collapsed £800 million contract for Cambridgeshire and Peterborough older people services. There are estimates that the collapse of that contract has cost the local hospitals, GPs and community care providers around £20 million. And as a third example, of course, Circle, the private company running Hinchinbrook Hospital, pulled out of that contract after just 2 years of a 10-year contract. Now, that company announcement came just after the publication of a damning report on the hospital from the CQC, which raised serious concerns about care quality, management and culture at the hospital.
One of the areas that I had concern was over the case of mid-staffs, in that a lot of what was blamed within the Francis report was the drive to have foundation status, and therefore senior management were totally fixated on that instead of fixated on quality of care to the patient. I think that consideration should be given to having clinical governance, which is that management are responsible for the clinical outcomes, not just the financial outcomes.
I thank her for her intervention. I think she makes a very important point. But in the last moments that are left to me, Madam Deputy Speaker, I just want to talk a little bit about the way in which what is happening to our NHS did not just happen, sadly, with the 2012 Act. It goes back further than that. So, in a sense, in order to protect the NHS for future generations, I think we need to recognise that there were several other stealthy acts of vandalism before that Act. So, Margaret Thatcher's government introduced the internal market right back in the 1990s. The Right Honourable Member for Rushcliffe was in charge and was following on from the so-called options for radical reform set out by the Right Honourable Member for West Dorset. And in its 1997 manifesto as well, New Labour promised to end the Tory internal market but actually embedded it even further. On those foundations, the now Lord Lansley, former Secretary of State for Health under the Coalition, drove through the Health and Social Care Act. And with that Act, no longer does the government or anyone else have a legal duty to provide hospital services throughout England. That duty to provide was severed. Universal provision was replaced with commissioning for registered patients. Healthcare was thrown open to any willing, hastily changed to any qualified provider. And shockingly, last October, we learnt that Lord Lansley has since been hired as a consultant to Bain & Company, which, according to its website, helps leading healthcare companies work on the full spectrum of strategy, operations, organisations and mergers. Now, that appointment at Bain was signed off in July 2015 by Baroness Browning, who herself chairs the Advisory Committee on Business Appointments, a consultant...
Order. Debate to resume what day?
2nd of April, Madam Deputy Speaker.
2nd of April.